Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 10th of February. February 25th at Blair House, across the street from the White House, Republican and Democratic lawmakers and the president will meet for a televised conversation about health care. Will the White House and Republicans negotiate seriously with each other? What are the principles and alternatives that Republicans have laid out that provide a roadmap to what a Republican health care bill would look like if they had the power to decide the outcome? And will there be any kind of health care reform, or is this pretty much for show? We're going to talk about all of that the first hour of the program. First, we'll get an update on the weather in Washington because our guest is a reporter for The Hill. Jeffrey Young is with us, and he's written quite a bit in Hill pieces about Republicans and Democrats and the president getting together to very visibly talk about the issue of health care reform. And so we will talk with Jeffrey, and we'll welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send us an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. My pleasure.
You may as well give us a weather update. I wouldn't normally do this, but I can't believe you're getting so pounded again.
Well, I don't expect any sympathy from your listeners, but I'll go ahead anyway. At the moment, it actually looks like the inside of a snow globe. Snow appears to be coming from all directions, and there's been some rain as well, which always adds a fun kind of aspect to the mix. I think that a lot of Washingtonians are probably like me right now and haven't seen much from the outside of their homes in a few days. They plowed my street yesterday, but now the snow's back. So,
and today you're getting another foot?
That's what it sounds like, yeah. This year, the accumulated snowfall this season has been more than, I think, something like the last five or six winters combined.
And it's really shut the city down, hasn't it? There aren't very many meetings taking place. Is the Senate in session, but the House isn't?
The Senate is, I think they are sort of nominally in session today. Mm. The House just decided to bag the whole week. Too many people couldn't make it back. But to give an idea of what was going on in the Senate, they had a vote yesterday, and 15 senators didn't make it.
That's
an extraordinarily high number.
Right.
And that's because even those who are in town, and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid mentioned this on the floor yesterday, even senators who are in town, in Washington, in the area, those who live in the suburbs, basically just couldn't get to the Capitol.
Right. Oh, and we had an earthquake last night. I was in the bathroom this morning, and the woman told me, "Did you hear about the earthquake?" I said, "Earthquake? What earthquake?" And it turns out there was an earthquake, and a lot of people in this part of the state, in the Milwaukee area, felt it. Plus, we got, 10 inches of snow. So what the heck is going on? Wild things everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of wild things, let's talk about February 25. How did all of this get arranged? Did the Republicans have to agree that they were going to go to this meeting?
Yes, although my understanding is that it played out like this. The president decided, and I don't know when, but the president decided he was going to announce during the Katie Couric interview before the Super Bowl on Sunday that he wanted to have this meeting. White House people got in touch with the leadership offices in Congress and the Republicans and Democrats and told them beforehand, president's going to say this. I don't know if, for example, House Majority or Minority Leader John Boehner had said, well, I don't want to go, if the president would have not said that. Mm-hmm. But, in situations like this, it's difficult for the minority because, there's politics is politics, but to a certain extent, the fact that, he's the president makes it a little difficult for them to just say, absolutely not. More than that, if you think about it from an optics standpoint, Republicans had hammered the president and the Democratic leadership on negotiating this bill in secret and not listening to ideas from the opposition. So the president comes out and says on national television before the highest rated thing on TV all year, I want to sit down with
right.
them. It's hard for them to say no.
Uh-huh. And what about the televised aspect of this? Who's televising it? It turns into another one of those meetings that he had, which was quite civilized and evidently worked well for the president when he went over and talked to them last week.
I would be very surprised if that were not the inspiration for having this televised event as well, because, you know, I think the president got good reviews from most people who saw that. You know, it's a good format for him because he's very smart. He knows the issues really well. He's, you know, he presents himself very well in public, you know, and as on a personal level, I think that his job approval numbers may be poor, but I think people tend to still like him. Plus, much like I was saying a moment ago, being the president of the United States, you're at an elevated level compared to all other elected officials in the federal government. So members of the opposition who may want to go after you, they may be disinclined to be too nasty directly to the president because it might be viewed as disrespectful. So he has certain advantages in a situation like that. And, you know, part of this, too, is that a lot of folks probably remember during his campaign, the president said over and over again, oh, well, we'll broadcast these health care negotiations on C-SPAN so everybody can see. And in spite of the fact that there were many, many, many hours of hearings and committee markups of the legislation and floor debate and all that stuff that was all right out there in the open that I was personally present for much of it, you know, especially at the end of the last few weeks before the Senate voted on Christmas Eve on its version of the bill, it was a few Democratic senators and a couple of staffers from the White House locked away in a room making the final decisions. And I think a lot of people maybe viewed that as a violation of the president's promise of openness. Mm-hmm. So this may be a way, too, of acknowledging, okay, well, I said that and then didn't do it, so let me try and make up for that by doing this. Of course, the difference is that, you know, those meetings that weren't on TV, they actually were negotiating the contents of the bill, and I don't think that's what we're going to see on the 25th.
Right. I guess the basic question here, considering how hard it has been for any kind of bill to get through the Senate and the back and forth and public option, no public option, the very strong opposition on the part of the Republicans to what Democrats have put forward. So the question is, can there really be serious negotiations between the White House and the Republicans?
Well, think of this. The president announces he wants to have this meeting. Right. And I'm sure everybody can kind of picture it, at least as I do. They're all sitting around a big table somewhere. Apparently, they're going to have this meeting in Blair House, which is across the street from the White House. You know, it's often used as a guest house or a meeting place for presidents. Harry Truman actually lived there while they were renovating the White House. But so they'll all be sitting around there. Everyone knows what they're going to say in advance. You know, they could have it today, probably. As far as what might actually come out of it, whether that meeting itself or any effort for the administration and the Democratic leadership of Congress, and then the Republican leadership of Congress, to come up with some kind of consensus or some sort of grand bargain. It's very telling that they're defining, the two sides are defining health care reform in very different ways. So, for instance, the president, and there's a lot more to it than this, but the president says, when he says, well, if you have any better ideas, I'd like to hear them.
Right.
Those ideas include subsidizing insurance coverage for 20, 30 or so million people. That's what makes the bills that already passed the House and the Senate so expensive. That costs a lot of money. The argument from that side is, well, if you don't get everybody or almost everybody into the healthcare system, none of the other reforms that are supposed to bring down costs or improve the quality of medical care, none of that works unless everybody's in. The Republican plans, and there's no one Republican plan, but those that are broader in scope as opposed to, you know, say for example, just a bill that deals with medical malpractice lawsuits, but something bigger than that, they don't seek to cover everybody. They don't even try to, and they don't pretend to try to. What they say is, we can't afford that, cost too much money, so let's see what we can do for the people who already have insurance, and maybe we'll sign a few more people up along the way. So if you see what I mean, the goals are so far apart.
Right.
So when the president says, well, I'm willing to listen to these Republican ideas at this meeting, but I'm not scrapping the bills we already passed, the Republicans say, well, if you're not going to scrap those bills, this isn't a true negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
They're starting out already setting up to me, it seems like they're acknowledging that they're not going to succeed. So this may end up being more like a debate or a series of competing presentations than a negotiation.
Do you think that there's any possibility that the president would say, all right, let's scrap the bills. Here we are. Let's start over?
Not based on anything he's ever said. And if you think about it from the Democrats' perspective, they have sunk so much into this. It's been a year.
Oh, it sure has.
A year of work, hours, time. I mean, the basic human element of it, I think should not be forgotten. It's politics, but I mean, you know, real life people have made this their 12-hour days for 12 months now. From the president, although he of course has other things to do, but members of Congress, staff, lobbyists for that matter, and journalists. It's difficult to walk away from the table when you've already, kind of bet all your chips on one thing. Not to mention that, the part of the politics of this is that if the Democrats don't get something from this, especially if it's something that actually looks like what they've been proposing all along, they'll look ineffective, I think it's safe to say. They've got, despite losing their 60th vote in the Senate, they still have two of the largest majorities in the House and Senate that any party has had in decades. They've got a president, a brand new president who came in with pretty high approval numbers, although that's changed. And if you talk to liberals, particularly people who work in the activism community or who are leaders at labor unions or other organizations that are allied with Democrats traditionally and that put a lot of work and money into getting Obama elected and into, over the course of a couple of election cycles, building up the Democratic majorities in Congress, they sort of want what they fought for. They want the change that they were promised to actually take place, and they want it to represent the liberal values that spurred them to put this effort forth in the first place. So were the president to say, and this is just sort of an absurd an absurd example of, if the president were to say, I'm so keen to get a health care bill passed that I will endorse John Boehner's bill, and then everybody will vote for it. Mm-hmm. If that were to happen, they'd get a bill passed, and maybe it would have bipartisan support, but they would anger and disillusion their own base of support on the left. So that's a disincentive, another disincentive to starting over.
So, Jeffrey, is there a unified Republican plan?
No, there's not. There are a handful floating around. And like I said, some of them are very narrowly targeted. So I'll leave those aside for the moment. The one that the Republicans are most likely to hype up at the meeting that's going to be taking place in a couple of weeks is the one that was put forward by John Boehner, the House Minority Leader. And there's also another plan, which is maybe a little more audacious, that was put out by Paul Ryan.
Yes, from Wisconsin.
Right, and some other members, including Tom Coburn from Oklahoma in the Senate. And again, I said this, but I'll emphasize it again. One of the key differences between these plans and what everything the Democrats have proposed is that they don't attempt to cover the uninsured in any large way. So, in terms of a value question, Democrats have campaigned for years, and there seems to be a widely held view among liberals that this is a moral imperative, that it's not right that all these people are not covered.
And there's probably a widely held view among Americans that the uninsured should be covered.
That's true, although not to sound like too much of a cynic, but like many other things, people believe something ought to be done but don't want to pay for it.
Right.
The president was being a little bit glib at that meeting with the House Republicans a couple of weeks ago in Baltimore that you mentioned. He said something to the effect of, well, if you could show me how we could do that without spending any money, why the heck wouldn't I want to join up with you? It's just not possible. So instead, what you tend to see in the Republican plans, it's kind of a collection of, for the most part, a collection of proposals that have been advocated by Republicans on health care for years, some of which looks like what Senator John McCain campaigned on when he ran against Obama, and some of it are bills that, as I've been covering health care for the last 10 years, I've seen when the Republicans control Congress, they would pass the House and not pass the Senate, which, so it's not just Democrats that run into that problem. So just as some examples, I mentioned medical malpractice reform. This is a big issue for Republicans. It's also a big issue for physicians. Democrats don't like the idea, for one thing, because you know there's this notion that if someone is wronged, whether it's by a doctor or anybody else, the courts are their last resort to, you know, to find a recompense or some measure of justice. In addition to which, the trial attorney lobby and the Democratic Party are very closely aligned. And if you're a trial lawyer, you don't want anything that's going to limit the ability of people to file lawsuits or win money.
Right.
So that's never gone anywhere, apart from passing the Republican-controlled House. Another big thing, and I don't know what the laws are like in Wisconsin, but state laws on insurance vary very widely on health insurance. So if you are an individual or you're part of a small group, say a small employer, and you are on the market for health insurance, as opposed to large companies, which work in a totally different national regulatory scheme, right? In some states, over the course of years, they've passed a series of laws guaranteeing you certain benefits. So, for example, you know, mammograms or diabetes coverage or any number of things. In addition to which, some states have also passed laws establishing that insurance companies can only raise your premiums by thus and such percentage, or that everybody in the state can be charged the same premium so that it doesn't exclude people with illnesses or pre-existing conditions and all those things. So the reasons behind laws like that are fairly obvious. People were trying to get insurance and they couldn't. Or they had insurance and their premiums would go up 100% over the course of the year because they got sick.
Yes.
So lawmakers in those states decided, well, we need to do something about this. The other effect of that, though, is that when you guarantee people packages of benefits or you limit the insurance company's ability to change their premiums, it tends to have the effect of making insurance more expensive for everybody. So that is that if you and I go to buy insurance and I'm very sick and you're very healthy and the insurance company has to charge us the same amount, that means they're going to charge you more. So a lot of these Republican health care bills say either federalize the regulation of these insurance through one means or another, such as you hear a lot of talk about allowing people to purchase insurance across state lines.
Right.
That's a big thing Republicans mm-hmm. talk about. And it makes a lot of sense in the sense that if I live in New Jersey, my insurance will cost me a lot more than if I live in, say, Oklahoma. The downside, and this is the argument that Democrats make, that the downside is that if you set up a system like that, you could end up where all the insurance companies flock to the state with the thinnest regulation and sell their products from there. And that would enable them to sell probably significantly cheaper policies to healthy people. But it opens questions up about what you do if you're sick or if you become sick. You know, there are measures like high-risk pools that are in some of these bills, too, that are meant to address those people. But one thing they don't do, you know, overall, is extend coverage to that many more people. So, for example, and you cut me off if I'm going on too long.
No, we need to understand this. It's fine.
The Boehner proposal, the Congressional Budget Office did an estimate of that back in November, and they said that, you know, so when they verified his claims that, yes, this plan would lower premiums for people who have insurance through several means, one of which is allowing these, you know, cross-state purchases. And, yes, in fact, it would, in comparison, just to give you an idea how much it costs to cover 30 million uninsured people, the Democratic bills spend about $800 billion to $1 trillion over 10 years on top of what we already spend on health care. Now, that's offset with new taxes and spending cuts elsewhere, but that's still the new money they need to spend to buy that stuff is, you know, right around $1 trillion. The John Boehner House Republican bill only spends, let me see. Oh, I thought I had the number in front of me. It's a tiny fraction of that. Oh, here it looks like a net cost of $61 billion. Sorry, gross cost. So $61 billion compared to a trillion. But again, you know, it's not because Democrats are lighting the money on fire. They're buying something with that the Republicans don't propose to purchase. Again, and I'm repeating myself, but again, because from a Republican standpoint, we simply can't afford to do that.
Yeah.
And if you look at that same Congressional Budget Office analysis, it says that the Republican plan, the House Republican plan, would increase insurance coverage to a few million people. But over the course of the 10 years they do that adjustment, the CBO says that even though it will be a few million more people with population growth and other factors, it's still the same percentage of the population would be without insurance at the end of that 10 years as would be at the beginning. So, you know, the question that the essential kind of values question and also budgetary question people need to ask is, what do we want these bills to do? Because whatever you ask them to do, that's how much they're going to cost.
Jeffrey Young is our guest. He is a reporter for The Hill, and as you heard him say, he's been covering health issues for and writing about them for 10 years. This hour of the program, we're asking the question, what do you hope the Republicans and the administration and Democrats will accomplish at their upcoming bipartisan summit on health care reform on February 25th, pretty soon now? We have one line open. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, many Americans are way too fat. We're going to be talking about the First Lady's initiative to combat childhood obesity. Will Allen, I'm sure many of you in Wisconsin are familiar with him. He has had an incredible life. He's the CEO of Growing Power. He received a MacArthur Grant in 2008, a Genius Grant. He's doing work in Africa now. And he was also a professional basketball player, and he was the youngest of six sons of a South Carolina sharecropper. He is the founder of Growing Power, which is Milwaukee's only urban farm, and he's created an international model for intensive urban agriculture and community food systems. Joining him, Jill Camber Davidson, who is a nurse and a nutrition education consultant with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Coupled with that, the president has called for major changes in the kinds of food and beverages that can be sold in schools throughout the country, so we'll look at that as well. All right, let's hop to phone calls as we talk once again about health care reform. It is amazing that this is the state we're in. We've done shows on this as well for a year now, and we're in about the same state we were in when we first started talking about this. Larry from Kingston is our first caller. Jeffrey, hi, Larry.
Hi. Your guest explained this dilemma very well. What I hope happens is that Democrats can expose the lies that the Republicans have brought forward, like death panels, and that it's going to affect Medicare. And another thing is, I hope that they could bring up the antitrust legislation that insurance companies are not under now. They need to be under antitrust laws. And, you know, I truly believe that, you know, that the Democrats are for the little people. They're for insuring 30 million uninsured people. They want to protect people from pre-existing conditions. They want to protect people from being dropped when they're sick. And the Republicans are all for the big insurance company and tort reform, which will protect the big insurance companies. And
all right. Thank you very much. I think there might be some Democrats who have a little bit of support from insurance companies as well, though, don't you think, Jeffrey?
I can tell you from looking at campaign finance numbers over the years, and I don't want to oversimplify it, but the money tends to follow who's in charge. So what you'll see is, you know, if you're an insurance company or a hospital corporation or a pharmaceutical company or what have you, and you're interested in, you know, keeping the people who are friendly to you in office, it tends to go to the chairperson of a committee, the majority members of a committee. What's actually happened, and I won't go off on too much of a tangent, but in years past, before the Democrats took over Congress back in the 06 elections, industries in general, and this includes healthcare, would give way more of their money to the majority party. That was true when Democrats ran things in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and it was true when the Republicans ran things in the 90s and the 2000s. When the Democrats took over, just to give you an idea of how money in politics works, for the most part, a lot of these interests kept giving money to Republicans. They just started giving more to Democrats. So they just started spending more overall. Oh. So the mix, instead of being 70-30, would be more like 60-40 or 55-45. So, yeah, you're right. You could find a lot of Democrats in Congress, including some of those who wrote these bills. We're getting checks from these insurance companies, too. I wanted to touch off of something the caller just said, if I may, actually.
Oh, of course.
When I did a story a couple of days ago about, you know, what people's expectations were from this summit coming up, and I spoke to a few people who work in, you know, left-leaning healthcare reform advocacy groups and leaders of groups like that, and they used basically the same terminology. They said, well, I hope that the president uses this as an opportunity while everyone's watching to say the following things that the Republicans said about my plan are simply not true, and spell that out, because there, you know, there are some things that have persisted apparently in the public mind that are very frustrating to Democrats because they feel like they don't reflect reality. So the caller has zeroed in on something that the White House appears to be thinking as well.
Yeah. What about this? Again, Larry, our caller pointed it to, and you've talked about this as well, this basic philosophical difference, not necessarily that Democrats are the little guy and Republicans are for corporations, but this idea of healthcare being something that everybody should have. It's a right as a member of this country to have healthcare. I would imagine that one of the things that could come out of this bipartisan conversation about all of this is that everybody might agree to that. I mean, it seems like a rational, reasonable, humane thing to do, to come out for, well, we really want to try to work for that. Philosophically, there shouldn't be a whole lot of difference in that area, should there?
Well, you know, the language that people use in politics is very telling, even if sometimes it's subtle. So if you ask a Democrat, and I'll generalize here for the moment, but if you ask a Democrat, do you think that everyone has a right to, you know, health coverage or health care when they need it? Most of them will say, well, yes, absolutely. And as I mentioned before, they will frame it in moral terms. It's not right that people don't have this.
Right.
No one else does, and it's life or death. And it's really awful when someone is in a situation where they need medical care and they can't get it, or it bankrupts them, and all the horror stories that happen in people's lives, you know, all the time. If you ask a Republican the same question, the standard answer you'll get is that everyone should have access to health coverage. And this is that, you know, it touches on the kind of fundamental philosophical divide that separates the two parties, and conservatives and liberals, and that, you know, tends to be the difference between, you know, the sort of right in the middle of our political system. And that is that, you know, when a Republican says, well, I think it's important that everyone have access to health insurance or access to a basic health plan, you know, this goes along with how that party tends to approach most issues, in the sense that it's not the government's responsibility or the appropriate role of the government to give everything to everybody. The government can organize the market, or, you know, prevent abuses, or, you know, facilitate things. And, you know, for instance, we come back to the idea of health insurance across state lines. If you deregulate these health insurance companies, then they can sell you a cheaper product. It may not be as good of a product, but will be less expensive, and more people will be able to buy it. But, yeah, I mean, this is why there's no easy solution to all of this, because people are approaching it from completely different,
yes,
you know,
yeah,
starting points.
Yeah. Larry, thank you so much for your good points. Anne from Madison is next. Hi, Anne.
Hi, this is really a frustrating issue, but I think that President Obama and probably 99% of members of Congress have forgotten that they don't represent the people who give them the most money. They represent the people who pay their salaries, and I don't know how much more President Obama could compromise. He's already supported the Max Baucus plan, which was put together, you know, with Republicans and conservative Democrats, so-called conservatives, basically sort of reactionary Democrats. And I just think that if you're not part of the solution.
You know, like, I remember that.
But anyway, you know, the problem is the insurance companies. And until for-profit insurance companies are kicked out of the system and aren't allowed to stuff our members of Congress's pockets with money and presidential candidates with pockets with money, we're not going to have the kind of Medicare, I think calling it Medicare, just as the Canadians call their whole system, for all is a great idea. And I can't see that compromising anymore with Republicans who basically want to privatize Social Security and Medicare. I mean, you know, how much more compromise without becoming a Republican can this president make?
Well, that's an interesting question. Jeffrey.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting point because, you know, if you've seen, you know, the bigger part of this story on this health care reform bill over the last year, and this is something the caller mentioned, Senator Baucus from Montana, hasn't really been, on Capitol Hill anyway, conservatives versus liberals or Republicans versus Democrats. It's been Democrats arguing with each other. The party has somewhat of a diversity of viewpoints, which incidentally is one of the reasons why they have the majority, because they, you know, kind of opened their doors to people who were less liberal than mainstream Democrats in order to win seats in places where a liberal couldn't win. And now they have members in their caucuses who don't want to vote for bills that are supported by most Democrats. But anyhow, there is a widely held view among liberal members of Congress and liberal activists that the starting point for these bills was already a capitulation. You know, I mean, many people, and the caller made a reference to this, unless I misunderstood her, but there are a lot of folks out there who think that the private health insurance system itself is fundamentally the problem, or that it's just not workable because, you know, to paraphrase Michael Moore in his movie about health insurance, you know, the way that an insurance company makes money is by not paying out claims. That's true of any insurance company. With your car, your house, you know, I think people see a different kind of moral stature, whereas not paying someone's medical bills or refusing to cover a procedure they need, you know, sort of, it appears to people who feel that way as an immoral thing. So for liberals, they look and think, well, we wanted single-payer health care, you know, sort of like Canada's, where the government pays the bills. And we go to private doctors and hospitals and all that stuff. But we'll give that up because Obama campaigned on something that was primarily private sector-based, and the Democratic Party in general, skittish from the Clinton years when they were portrayed as trying to enact a socialist takeover of one-sixth of the American economy, and that idea seemed to resonate with people and seemed to be attached to the party even after 10 or more years. Well, let's move the entire project to the middle and start from there. Well, Republicans have no incentive politically to give them credit, so to speak, for having moved to the middle already. So they start out with a bill that you know uses private insurance companies for most people, and then over the course of the process, they remove the public option insurance plan from the bill. Although that wasn't for Republicans, that was for those conservative Democrats. But so they look, you know, like the caller said, they look and they go, well, how much more do I have to give up? I'm still a Democrat. Why are we not doing it our way? And that also makes it difficult. And I'm reminded of there was a quote. President Clinton, when he was working on his health care plan, had a meeting with a moderate Republican senator in his office in the White House, and I forget who it was, so I'm not going to try and guess, who was trying to work on a compromise plan. If you imagine sort of the Olympia Snow of 1993, and said, well, I don't know, this is President Clinton supposedly said, I don't know what to do here because every time I move to the middle, Bob Dole, who was the Senate Majority Leader at the time, moves the middle to the right. And I think Obama has seen some of the same thing.
We need to pause for a moment and we'll return and take more calls. Ann, thanks very much for your call. We also have some emails that are coming in. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk at WPR.com. www.theideasnetwork.org. Our guest is Jeffrey Young, reporter for The Hill, who has spent a great deal of time writing about healthcare for the past 10 years. That's a long time. And our focus this hour is the White House scheduling a televised meeting with GOP leaders for February 25 to talk about their ideas on healthcare reform and to see if Republicans and Democrats may be able to come together on some kind of reform. We'll take more calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After the news at 10 o'clock, we'll be talking about the First Lady's initiative that was announced this week, the Let's Move campaign to tackle childhood obesity. We'll have two guests with us, Will Allen, who's from Milwaukee and was in Washington and one of the speakers when this was announced yesterday. He is the CEO of Growing Power, and we'll also be speaking with Jill Camber-Davidson, nutrition education consultant with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Back to phone calls for Jeffrey. Let's go to Roger from Sauk County. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I have a point. I have two friends. Both had their gallbladders removed. One had insurance, one didn't. The one with insurance had a couple doctor's appointments, got in, got it done, probably cost around $10,000. The other one didn't have insurance, had two emergency room visits, ended up in the hospital for 4 days with an insurance, with an infection, and ended up getting IVs, antibiotics, ended up costing more than $30,000. She has no income. She is, thankfully for herself, supported by someone who loves her and doesn't have an income because of untreated and unmanaged mental illness. The hospital will end up writing off all of that $30,000-plus. So as they go to the table and they talk about the cost, does the number of how much hospitals write off every year because of the uninsured actually get brought to the table? And what I hope for at this meeting is actual peer honesty.
Pure honesty. We all hope for that, don't we, Jeffrey?
Yeah, well, the people we elect, once they get in, sort of define honesty for themselves, I think. You know, it's interesting what he mentioned about hospitals kind of writing off unpaid bills, because he's actually touched on something that's a huge part of this healthcare reform that nobody ever really talks about. Hospitals, you know, everyone is sort of, you know, when people think about where do we spend our money in the healthcare system? Everybody thinks about their insurance premiums, and they think about how their drug costs have gone up. At least if you have insurance, you know, maybe your co-pays are higher than they used to be, that sort of thing. But we still, like we did, you know, 50, 100 years ago, what have you, we still spend most of the money in healthcare in hospitals. It's the most expensive place to get treated. It's also where the most complicated things happen. Hospitals are heavily dependent on Medicare and Medicaid for their livelihoods. If you think about it, it makes sense, especially Medicare. Older or disabled people are more likely to need more serious medical care than younger, relatively healthier people, and older, sick, older or disabled people are who's on Medicare. There are systems already built into Medicare and Medicaid. It's kind of an indirect way of taking care of the problem, but the federal government already funnels out billions and billions of dollars every year to hospitals to try and make up for the fact that they have people who don't pay their bills. So if you think about it, and that's another way of putting that, is that taxpayers are already picking up part of the tab for care that uninsured people receive at the hospital. So what the bills in Congress would do, and President Bush, incidentally, proposed the same thing, although for a very different health care proposal in his second term. They say, well, we're already spending billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars a year on these special payments to make up for, you know, so hospitals don't have to completely write off the unpaid bills. Let's just take that same money and put it into subsidies for health insurance. And that is one of the largest kind of cost-cutting mechanisms in these bills is more or less phasing out, eliminating those payments that go out to hospitals now and putting that money in a pot to pay for health insurance for people. So when they go to the hospital gets paid by the insurance company. And people may not remember this because it didn't make as much of a splash as when the drug companies did the same thing. But the hospital industry and the White House sort of struck a deal last summer where the hospital industry agreed in advance, you know, that they would, if not fully endorse the healthcare plan, they wouldn't fight to try to kill it. And what they got in exchange for that was somewhere on the order of $155 billion in cuts to their Medicare and Medicaid over 10 years. But what they also got was a population with health insurance around 94, 95, 96% or so, you know, once you add in the 30 million people that these bills seek to give insurance for, which means that they know where the money, they know the money's coming in. They know when someone presents at the hospital that someone's going to pay their bill, and it eliminates a lot of anxiety and unpredictability for the hospitals on the money side. So, yes, that actually is part of what they're talking about.
Thanks for the call. We have a couple emails. Let me combine them and take parts or whatever you'd like. Why can't we just have Medicare for all, or is that too simple? My question to you, Jeffrey, is whether or not that will be part of the discussions on the 25th. That comes from Susan from Arlington. And Steve from Whitewater says, when will anyone in Congress stand up and simply state the very same health insurance policy that is good enough for the members of Congress should be good enough for all of our constituents? Period. End of discussion.
Well, to the first question, you know, I talked about single payer before. Doing opening up Medicare to everyone is one way of doing that because it is an existing program. Simply put, the president, Democratic leadership in Congress made an early determination that they did not have the votes for that and that the public wouldn't like it, that it would be, you know, portrayed as socialism or what have you. Now, of course, what they have done has also been portrayed as socialism, so it didn't really eliminate
right.
that argument.
Right.
But that's basically what it comes down to. There's a political calculation that they don't feel that that will be popular. So they ruled it out. You know, I mean, there's no way of knowing whether that was the wrong move. But and we'll have to see it politically, I mean, at the end of this. And the second point, you know, it's an interesting thing. You know, politicians kind of created a trap for themselves over the course of many years when they talked about health care, I think, when they would stand in stump speeches and rallies and floor speeches and congressional debates and say, you know, people should have access to insurance, to coverage as good as members of Congress have. And I think to a certain extent, it's led people to think that these members of Congress have some kind of amazing health insurance plans. The people who are members of Congress and White House staff, I don't know, the president's a different story, but they have access to the same health insurance as, you know, the clerk at the federal building in your state capitol.
Yes.
It's the same insurance plan. You know, all federal employees have access to the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, which provides them choices of a number of different plans they can pick based on what they want. And they vary by where you live, but it's actually the exact same system. The advantage that they have over a lot of other folks, even including those who have insurance, is that because the federal government is so big, they can offer more choices of, you know, where you live, because they have so many people, especially if you think about here in Washington, there's many, many federal employees in this area. So part of the concept behind the plan that the Democrats have put together and that they passed the House and Senate already, and quite similar to what the president campaigned on, is to set up a similar system for everybody else, not to let them buy in to the federal employees plan, although that, you know, that certainly would be simple, but then there's complications there and union issues and all other kinds of things. But to say, like, well, one of the reasons that this is good for federal employees is that we put everybody in a big pool and we say to the insurance companies, well, make us an offer, and 10, 20, 40 of them, 50 of them, whatever, come forward with different products, and then people can choose between them. That's what this exchange that they talk about is supposed mm-hmm. to work like. Whether it's one nationwide exchange, which the House bill would do, or whether it's 50 state-based exchanges, the idea would be that if you don't get insurance at work, you go online or you call a hotline and you tell them what your situation is and what you want and how much you can afford to pay, and then up pops your choices. Sort of like you're shopping for an airfare or booking a hotel or something like that. So that is fundamentally the structural basis of this whole new insurance system that these bills would create, is the Federal Employees Plan, which is what Congress gets.
Yeah. Michael is our next caller. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Just fine.
Good.
I agree with your very first call you had on there. I pray that this summit, whatever they want to call it, exposes the Democrats. It's not, the Republicans are not willing to negotiate or to really look out for the smaller people. It's easy to talk about saving money when you have insurance. So my question would be is how can they sit there with a straight face and say that they are for the majority of the people when the people are not saying that?
I'm sorry. I don't think I understand.
Okay. How can, you know, every time I listen on the news, you know, to what the Republicans, I try to be fair, what they're saying that they're doing what the people want and that the Democrats right. are not, or that President Obama is not. And, I mean, even the last call talked about how far we have moved to the middle to try to accommodate these people who don't care about the people who really need this type of program. And then we're talking about the what it costs when you go to the hospital without health insurance and the cost it puts back on the people.
Yeah, it is true that the Republicans have said again and again that the American public strongly disapproves of the plans that are in Congress. I'm not sure if that's true, but we tend to believe now because they've said it over and over that that is true, right?
Well, there definitely is something to that. I mean, it's a tried and true tactic in politics that if you say something often enough, it can take root in people's minds if they didn't already have an opinion. I think that the basis for those claims right now and throughout most of the year-long, you know, process on putting these health care bills together is that the polling on it has been really mixed at best. There are showing that, you know, people don't like the plan or they don't approve of the president's handling of it, or you may take out individual parts of the plan, and some of them may look quite popular and some of them may look quite unpopular, and in a way that makes perfect sense. You know, nobody, I would think, out there who purchases health insurance would think it was a bad idea to ban insurance companies from not selling you something because you have a pre-existing condition. Anybody we were talking about before would probably say, yeah, I think the people who don't have insurance should have access to it, and if they can't afford it, maybe we should help them out. But if you turn it around to the other side, they say, well, should we raise taxes on this or should we raise taxes on that to pay for it? They say, absolutely not. And then you have, you know, some things where in order to get, you know, particular members of Congress on board for the bill, you give them something a little special. And what got most of the attention, there were some other examples of this, was when Senator Ben Nelson from Nebraska got some extra money for his state's Medicaid program. You know, this did not go well. Apparently.
No, it shouldn't go well.
Yeah. So, you know, that sort of thing could have the, it basically confirms people's stereotypes of how Washington works. So even if, and this is not the case, but even if that were the only example of that in this bill, it's still, people will see that and go, I knew it. I knew that's how they did business there. So that can hurt the popularity of things, you know, but I think the main point is, and this is sort of what you were talking about, you know, it's seen by people who run for office and hold office as a winning strategy to always claim that you have the mantle of public support behind
right.
what you're doing, even if you have no basis for it. And in this case, there are poll numbers they can point to support the idea that people aren't thrilled about what's going on.
Yeah. Let me ask you, we're just coming down to the end, but we may have time for one more call. Don't you get something? The Republicans, you expect the Republicans will get something if they're in power. You expect the Democrats. And we got a Democratic House and Senate and presidency, for heaven's sake. Don't they get something for winning? It seems ironic to me that we're at this position where, after all this debate, after all these ideas, after passing bills in the Senate and the House, it now comes down to the president meeting with Republican leaders to get some kind of bill passed. It just seems, it doesn't jive.
It's a little funny, as I mentioned before. I mean, they have huge, even though they only have 59 in the Senate, only 59. That's a pretty high number.
It is
the highest number that anyone's had for quite some time. So, yeah, you know, and I think if there was a story that came out when the president had some Republican leaders in the White House at the very beginning of his presidency to talk about the stimulus bill, you know, I forget who he was talking to at the time, but someone was saying, well, Mr. President, we do like this and we don't like this and we don't want you to do that and we don't want you to do this on the stimulus bill. And he apparently interrupted them and said, I won.
Right.
Which is sort of amusing and is a good point. But it has not translated in practice into, you know, getting something this big accomplished, which, again, you know, if you Republicans have been so adamantly opposed to moving these health care bills forward that, you know, if you're trying to figure out why they haven't, you might want to look at the majority party and ask, why haven't you been able to move this when you control everything?
Maybe he needs to say, I'm going to use my capital, huh?
Yeah.
Thanks, Michael. We have time for maybe one more call, just a comment. I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. Brad is next. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. Yeah, I heard yesterday in the news that Anthem of California is raising in rates on their insurance plans by 39%. And if we follow the Republican model, we're going to wind up with very, very high deductible consumer-driven plans. And I'm wondering why the Democrats and Obama don't champion a Medicare for All system. And because they're not talking about it, all the public hears by default is the Republican talking point.
We have 10 seconds, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people who feel frustrated about that. And you know, the only thing I can observe, and if you ask people a year ago, Democratic leaders, why not? They'd say, we don't think it'll pass.
Ooh, that was good. You did it in 10 seconds. Exactly. You were a great guest here. Thanks, Jeffrey, so much.
My pleasure.
We'll be on this issue, of course, before and after the February 25th. Date when everybody's meeting at Blair House. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to Chrissy Peace for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee, and to you as well. If you want to put your comments on Facebook, too, we're trying to use that as much as possible because I'd love to hear what you say. If you didn't make it on the air or your email didn't make it because we had tons of calls and a lot to talk about, just go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and give us your comments. We'd love to read them. This is the Ideas Network.